You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 21st of April 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé and Emma Nelson.
Coming up on today's programme, we find out what's been selling well in the bookshops of Chicago and Skopje, and we also hear how the Salone del Mobile in Milan has impacted on the bookseller Pietro Coraini.
We know that during the Salone we sell books that we don't sell during the year.
And we'll also be chatting with Thai funkster Math Tsai for some musical recommendations.
And we'll be working through the pages of our stack of magazines with the fashion entrepreneur, Alexia Hench.
Emma, your Saturday night is all sorted out right here on The Review on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé and Emma Nelson.
Just Saturday night sorted out, Monday through Friday
as
well.
You're going to be whizzing around Manchester Square in your little tuk-tuk, aren't you?
I am.
But you were telling me a story this morning, which was more alarming, about an exercise class that happens in the park not too far from here.
It's one of those things that if you were ever caught doing it by someone who was important, you would be
which
absolutely
means you,
mortified.
We know you have a disguise.
It's a large hat, false beard next time. It is a ladies and gentlemen, it is a postnatal exercise class.
Right.
And it is designed for women who want to lose the baby fat and generally get out of the house without killing themselves. And it is called Pushy Mothers. And six women assemble in Regent's Park. And we all dress up in proper exercise gear, and then we go for power walks around the park.
With your pram?
With our pram, with our baby.
With baby.
And then you sort of overtake each other in a kind of Formula One setup. And then they take you to the little running track at the other side of Regent's Park, and you all line up in your respective rows, and then you race. And then you go and do aerobics under trees. And apparently it's become an incredibly big phenomenon on the internet that people have been taking photographs of this thing.
Right.
Because I don't know about you, but my exercise is quite a private thing. And even if I'm running, you know, I try and keep my head down and,
yeah,
you know, I'm not necessarily in the mood to engage with the general public. But with this one, you are just like a sore thumb, all these excited pushy mothers who
now, before we went
love
on air,
their exercise.
I must heard you because I didn't know it was pushy mothers. I thought you called it was bushy mothers.
That's something else, Tyler.
Right, okay. Should we get on with our program? I haven't seen you in a while.
I haven't seen you. You've been
and
on
you're
your
looking,
travels.
You are looking very svelte, though, in your tuxedo shirt this
well,
morning.
Well, it's the pushy mums that's doing it. It's the exercise things in Regent's Park. Wednesday mornings, 11 o'clock, ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely.
If you want to giggle.
If you're in London,
if you happen to.
Do you think
to,
there's sponsorship opportunities for Monocle, maybe?
I'm not entirely how on brand they are, but I could explore it. It's all very pink and lilac.
Okay.
It's all very high energy and lots and lots and lots of slogans.
I'm seeing a high gloss black and white. Maybe old school pram, sort of proper big wheeler.
A proper silver cross.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you have to get lightweight for this one, unless you want to make life particularly difficult for yourself.
Excellent. You are listening to The Review. We're in London. We're back in a moment.
We start today with our regular dip into the world's bookshops to see what's been selling well.
First, we head to Milan, where we were all week, in fact, at the Salone del Mobile Furniture Fair, which we reported with the Globalist. Were you tuning in all week, Emma? We were there almost every single morning, hour two. Our special series of shows covering the event can still be downloaded, of course, anytime you want, off our website or, of course, via iTunes. We popped along to visit design and children's bookstore 121 Plus. Do you want to say that in Italian for us?
121.
That's in Milan. Went there to find out how the fair impacts their sales.
Hi, I'm Pietro Coraini. I'm a publisher and a bookstore manager. We have a bookstore in the middle of the Fuori Salone. We like the Salone del Mobile because it's another way to leave the city, but we have the bookstore also when there is not the Salone del Mobile. So we can see the difference between the week where all the design world is in Milano and all the rest of the year.
Right.
So there is a big difference between this week and the rest of the year. Usually we sell a lot of children's book and a lot of graphic design book. During the Salone there are a lot of book about design, like similar to showcases of designer. So I think because there is a professional world here in Milano and they buy a lot of catalog of exhibition about design or showcases of the best design around. We just published a catalog of the design museum. Of course, we keep selling our usual books, so children's book, the Bruno Munari books, but we see the increase in the selling of the books just for professionals. There is this one about the graphic design world, the exhibition there is at the Salone del Mobile, and then there is this magazine that is called Inventario, and it is selling really well. We are selling the catalog of a strange exhibition that we made for this exhibition about paper roll in Torino, just the new titles, and for the title that we usually have in the bookstore. It's strange because I don't see increasing or decreasing. It's the usual amount of books and just arrive a new kind of people selling books. So we know that during the Salone we sell books that we don't sell during the year. So we bring on front all the back issues that we don't know how to sell, we sell to the designers. Yes.
And that was Pietro Coraini making money out of old rope, I think.
I was going to say, just roll out all the tat when everyone else comes into town.
They'll buy it. Congratulations, Pietro Coraini, for letting yourself betray yourself with your sales pitch.
I thought that was good, though.
I liked him.
Good, honest Italian.
I liked him, yes. Great. All these designers sitting, going home with their was it 121 bags, just kicking themselves on the train, going, I've been had. Pietro's done me again.
Oh, well. You missed a good one in Milan this week. We had a really great party with our friends from Helsinki, because Helsinki is world design capital.
Yeah.
So we had a great event on, was it Tuesday? Wednesday evening in Milan. And it was nice because it was one of those... It's normally there's just so many parties and everyone is trying to have a bigger share of voice, and you have the entire global design scene there. But what was nice about this event was that it wasn't sort of a drop in drop out, because it was a better party to go to. There might have been a better party to go to, but people were just so comfortable. It was relaxed. It was sort of the Nordic world, which was also good. So it just sort of gave it a certain sort of level and calm.
It cooled things down after the Salone, which I imagine is enormous.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, aside from just going to the Fiera, to this enormous site out in suburban Milan. This is the big number for the year. But there's just so many satellite events all over the city. And then, I think one of the big problems has been probably, for the last 5 years, maybe for the last decade, just anyone else who might be remotely connected to design wants to hitch their red wagon to it. So you've got all of these companies which have nothing to do with design, and then suddenly they've got, a couple of, you mentioned the word rope, well, ropey chairs, in their front windows and hoping to entice people, through their front doors.
We spoke to Hugo on Midori House a couple of days ago, and he was saying that it's got a bit skinnier this year, because I think they realised that the Salone was getting very flabby. But the local designers have decided that they're not actually going to the fair itself, that they've turned Milan into their own exhibition.
Exactly. And I think this is a part of it, is just that, not so much the logistics. Getting out there is not so bad. But when you get there, and actually the good thing, even though the weather wasn't great in Milan, the problem is you're under these, these canopies of glass. So as soon as it gets above 20 degrees, I mean, you've really had it.
You're in a greenhouse.
Completely. and it all becomes rather unpleasant. Let's go to Chicago right now, where we're going to visit Unabridged Bookstore and talk to one of their buyers, Yanni Grammatis, not the owner, but in fact the children's book buyer.
My name is Yanni Grammatis. I'm one of the children's book buyers for Unabridged Bookstore in Chicago. It's one of Chicago's independent bookstores, celebrating its 31st year in the neighborhood of Lakeview. We're a full-service general bookstore, specializing in children's literature and also paying an homage to the roots of the neighborhood with a really well-stocked gay literature section. And I also have to say that, without any false modesty, that we have the largest travel section in the city. It's kind of astonishing that it's almost like a hidden secret. A lot of people are very surprised to find, first, we have a basement, and secondly, we have such a large travel section. And it's the usual suspects like Frommer's or Lonely Planet or Eyewitness to a lot of small presses with titles ranging as the best coffee shop in Edinburgh to, you know, the best pastries in Paris. In addition, we can't really forget the popular zeitgeist. Books like Hunger Games or sort of like dystopian young adult literature has definitely seen an increase in sales. I just finished the sequel to Divergent, which is another futuristic, post-apocalyptic sort of book that surprisingly takes place in Chicago of an undetermined future. And the sequel is coming out in May, and it's called Invergent. And I just finished it, and I thought it was exceptional, very quite good. And also the landmarks that are mentioned in the Chicago future were pretty haunting and a fun read for me. So the book we're promoting this week is City of Scoundrels by Gary Crist. First of all, it's a book of local interest. It takes place in 1919, and over the course of 12 days that sort of altered the modern history of Chicago, starting with a horrific blimp disaster, followed by horrible race riots that shook the city, a crippling transit strike, and a sensational child kidnapping that the political sort of establishment of Chicago tried to co-op and use to their advantage or not. I expect it to be a big hit. Our clientele runs the gamut. I mean, they're avid fiction readers, but I do say that nonfiction books sell a lot more. I can't lie to you that there were some very lean years, but I think we are thriving now. It's a testament to the loyalty, I guess, of our customer base in Lakeview. They're all really well read and appreciate the service that we provide to them.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Have a good night, guys. Thanks.
We're here to stay, and I don't foresee any real danger for now.
And that was Yanni Grammatis feeding the pinch for a little while, but then saying that everything is all right now. I was slightly surprised when we introduced it as a children's book buyer, and then he subsequently went on about post-apocalyptic fiction and blimp disasters. Not entirely sure that the child's taste are just quite ready for that yet.
Yeah, well, I was quite fascinated by the Hindenburg as a child, so, you know.
Possibly.
We should let's head to Skopje now, where we're going to meet the owner of the bookshop, pronounced Tree, pardon me, Alexander Sazdov.
Hello, my name is Alexander Sazdov from Skopje. I work at Tree Publishing Center in Macedonia, 33 years old now. The bookshop is found on the oldest city shopping mall in Skopje. It's near the main square, Macedonia. According to these coordinates, we are at a good location. Near our bookshop is the biggest cinema in Skopje, so we have complementary fields of business. When we started thinking about our new bookshop, we wanted to implement something new. Our general feeling about the bookshops and the libraries is something old, something wood, something monotone, something warm. But we wanted to do something very different. So we placed as many colors as we could in our bookshop. As you can see, the ground, the floor is made of maybe 40 different colors. I feel very cozy here. I feel very, very beautiful. And when people arrive, they put a little smile on their face, so they like them. They like it. They like the color. They like the lights, and of course the books. Well, the shopping window is very important for attracting customers. We placed big posters of the biography of Steve Jobs, and also a big poster of Vinka Sazdova, The Fields of Wild Tardrovs, and of course hundreds of other popular books. At this moment, the most popular books is the biography of Steve Jobs. Also, Haruki Murakami is very, very popular. But I can certainly say that in Macedonia, there is now some trend that Macedonian readers want to read our authors, Macedonian authors. So we have Vinka Sazdova with her book, The Fields with Wild Dardovs. which is very, very, very popular. We have Wanku 8-4 by Murakami, the third part of the book. We have Language of Flowers. We have Jarko Laušević, one of Balkans' very, very famous actor. Just yesterday we were discussing, because our slogan of our company is In Love with the Books. And we have won three. And we were yesterday we were looking for something new, and we came on an idea to call it We Are Rising. So that means that we are rising all day and all, every day and every day. So we have our group of members, but this number is rising every day.
And that was Alexander Sastov being somewhat cozy in Skopje.
Cozy in Skopje with the lights and the lovely colours on the floor. I thought that was delightful, because I possibly wasn't particularly polite about his voice when I heard it. I thought it was rather very, very sort of deep and gruff. Mm. And actually, the further we got into that piece, the more charming he became, and so sort of very sweet and gentle.
And it's interesting. I wonder if Iani from Chicago and maybe Alexander, they're almost neighbours as well, because I imagine probably Iani's probably from Thessaloniki or somewhere. So just around the corner. Anyway, stay with us, because coming up after the break, we're going to be going to Thailand. Did you know that?
I did know that, actually. I was given a clue at the beginning of the programme by that piece of music. We'll be getting some musical recommendations from Bangkok. Ladies and gentlemen, brace yourselves.
From São Paulo to Sapporo, from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires, with a samba, bossa, jazz, poppier, rock and roller, frankly far superior station, to discover the newest and finest sounds. This she makes me wanna dance. Is the sound of Monocle spinning its musical globe. Check in with our editors turned DJs as they whisk you through the time zones as we take you continental, Atlantic and Pacific. Round the clock, round the block, music on Monocle 24.
On this week's edition of The Menu with me, Markus Hippi, we will visit Australia to check a new wave in small bars. We also speak Arabic cuisine, get tips on how to name your restaurant, and get the latest on airplane food. Of course, we will find out what's in Santiago's basket. We'll get a great dinner soundtrack recommendation and, as always, much, much more on this week's episode of The Menu.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
And you're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson, and Tyler Brulé. Welcome back.
And it's now time for a weekly music review. And today we're heading to Bangkok, and we're going to be talking to Mafsai, owner of Zudrangma HQ record label. And I believe he is on the line now. Sawadee.
Sawadee Krab.
How are you?
Not too bad at all. How are you doing?
Very, very well. We were just chatting before we went on air. I was chatting to Emma about just the power of Thai pop and T-pop, and really, it's very interesting if you look at for example, I guess a little bit up the street in South Korea. You have one of the front men for 2PM, for example, has really become this sort of poster boy. Here's a Thai Thai performer, who's found his way into a Korean boy band, and it was just interesting when I was in Bangkok recently, sort of seeing how he's kind of sort of he's everywhere. And do you think that Thai pop has been, of course, around for a while? You're doing some very interesting things. Were you able to sort of launch this label because, now people want to know and really sort of go through the back catalogue of what exists, in Thai popular music?
Yeah, I think it's actually quite an interesting thing, because when we started it, it was not the tie of the Thai popular music from back in the day was not really picking up this much until a couple of labels from abroad and for our label as well start promoting it, and people start seeing the difference, the different music and different production that back in the day, there's still a time where they're kind of more experimenting with the music, than today, where it's mostly the business industry.
Mm. And, as a result of that, and I mean, before we go and listen to something, I mean, maybe just tell us a little bit about the evolution of your label, and then we'll go and listen to a song. But where did you see an opportunity in the market? I mean, like so many of these things, was it just sort of a passion to get some of this out there, or did you also see that there was definitely sort of a financial opportunity in doing this as well?
I mean, when we first started, it was mainly just the personal stuff, like the labor of love, you know, because I started it from being a DJ and just basically digging the old music from Thailand, because there's not really much of the label where they're still keeping the archive of the old music. All of this old music can only be found on the original record.
Fans love the music for what they describe as its brilliant strangeness, and I must confess I hadn't actually heard anything like it before until I heard a little bit a few hours ago. Who actually listens to your music, or the music that you play, and who comes to the nights that you DJ at?
The night we DJ throw a party at Bangkok, it's basically really a mixture of crowd from the local Thai that quite open to like the old music, from young to old, and people working in the NGO, in the UN, people working in the press within Thailand and stuff. They actually quite come to the event quite often. And, well, we just, at the end of the day, just the people with open-minded for new or interesting music that not often hear, not often play in the country.
I mean, is there a spirit of nostalgia there, or is it does it feel incredibly fresh and new when you play the tunes?
It's actually a couple of situations when we're putting the old records on, and people just walk up to us and ask whether we make a remix version of this track when it's actually come out from the original recording, and people just forgotten about the production, how was it from back in the day.
Right, well, it does have a very particular production feel to it, doesn't it? We'll have a listen to some of the tracks that you've released on your label. We'll play a little bit of a song that you recommended to us, and then we'll ask you to talk to us about it. This is My Jom Kalon by Dao Bandun.
And you are listening to My Jom Kalon by Dao Bandun here on The Review in London. We're talking to Maf Sai, owner of Zun Drangma HQ record label. Matt, there's something very evocative about that, because it conjures up so many images when I listen to it. I've spent a lot of time in Bangkok, not a lot of time elsewhere in the country. So tell us a little bit about the track.
Basically, the style of music is actually called Luk Thung. And I mean, in Thailand, there's a couple of genres of music. It's Luk Thung, Luk Groong, Mo Lam, and Le. And the track from Dao Bandun just now that been played is from the style of Luk Thung, which is straight translation, is the son of the field. And this music is actually kind of a folk music of Thailand, where it's kind of talking about everyday life, about the thing that happened in the certain era. And with this track, it's actually recorded in 1975. And the track was, the instrumental and the style of music is actually a lot of influence from the GI that was coming to Thailand for the reason of the Vietnam War. And they actually import in all the different instrumental and also instrument, and also the style like soul, like Santana, and different style of music, bring it into the country. So people locally, they start mixing the local Thai and experimenting with the stuff from Western.
So this would have been listened to by GIs?
Yep.
That's quite amazing to actually think that this was on, sort of on the turntables on a Friday night. That was quite astonishing. What got you into this kind of music in the first place? Because you moved from London to Bangkok, didn't you?
Yep. I mean, it's just basically every country I go, every place I school, I it's just the first thing I do is just looking for records and just searching for music. When I come back to Thailand, I actually don't really know much about the old Thai music in general, and I just go to the record store with the portable turntable and just start listening to the music. And a certain of the production, it just straight away remind me of like the music from Ethiopia or Mali or even some from Jamaica. So I start to be into that, and the more I hear, the more unique sound I found within the old Thai music as well.
Well, why don't we go in and listen to something else? This is something from Quanjit Sripachan. The song is called Tumbun Kantur.
Quanjit Sripachan there. Maf Tsai, owner of Zudrangma HQ record label in Bangkok, tell me about this woman. Her voice is astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, this woman, she's still actually performing this day. The style that she specializes in is actually called Lair music, which is the more of the relation music, form of music that we use normally in the temple ceremony. And like, for example, if you decided to be a monkhood and go, and you have to, you know, with the ceremony, shave your head, and all your family will be gathering together. This last singer will be introducing to the ceremony and will start singing tracks about the story of the Buddhism, the story of Buddha, the karma, respecting the parents, about everyday life. And this, the track that Quanjit Sripachan was singing just now, is about doing the good sin, and you know, what comes around goes around. So it's a lot of Buddhism teaching in the within the vocal, as well as the soulfulness of her vocalist, you know.
Sorry,
I was just going to say, we were looking at some images of Quanjit Sripachan, and I don't think she's ever seen a razor on top of her head. She looks a little bit, at least contemporary images I've seen, she looks a bit like Imelda Marcos.
Yeah.
Sorry, Emma.
So how do you get this combination then of this obviously very religious and ethereal music combined with a very flamboyant brass section and a decent funky beat to go with it?
Yeah, because I mean, basically back in the day, I mean, most of the also the concert or the big events with music related to musical events normally happened in the temple, because it's the place when all the local community come to celebrate or to come to joy up for a certain ceremony, the party, the temple fair. They used to have a temple fair. And all of this music would be played, not just teaching the story of Buddha, but also entertaining people as well.
I must confess, we were looking on a couple of social media sites, and you were advertising a midweek rejuvenation session of free spiritual jazz. That sounds really quite something to go to. What are those evenings like?
Basically, those evenings I just play basically a mixture of the spiritual jazz record that I've been collecting over the year, from record like Sun Ra to Moon Dog, Ashishiv, many production, not only the Thai stuff, but it just because locally in Thailand there's not much of the places or the night where people can actually hear the underground music or the music that's not often. This sort of music is not often been played within the country. There's a lot of bar and clubs in Thailand, but they're pretty much playing the similar style of music. So we try to, we and our neighbors, like basically very close to our store, there's a bar called the WTF Bar, and we try to promoting the different style of music in Thailand.
Maf, let's move on to a track from a compilation that you're working on with a Japanese label. This is Our Ari Seesaw by Tong Howd.
And that was Our Ari Seesaw by Tong Twad here on The Review on Monocle 24. And we're talking to Maf Sai, who's in Bangkok. Tell us a little bit about that, because when we heard it the first time, it brings to mind a little bit of the West Country of Ireland. Emma was about to sort of break into a bit of river dance. What are the influences of this particular sound?
Basically, with this particular artist, the instrument is called saw. He's the saw specialist. Saw is kind of like the Thai northeastern violin, made up from the kind of wooden bass with three strings as well. And the style of music is actually called Molam, which Molam is the style of music that kind of specialized in Isan, which is the northeastern part of Thailand. And the in Molam music, it can date back over like 1,000 years with the pin and can, which is the local Isan instrument. And the style of this track is called Lamplern, which Lamplern is in Molam, there's different rhythm of music. So it's kind of the fixed rhythm, and they start introducing the kind of the drum, the bass line in the 70s, then when they do more experiments, but with the local instrument mixed in.
This has a very different feeling from the two other tracks that you've played us. And you say you're working with a Japanese label. How is that working out at the moment?
It's actually just released, compilation just released last month. And I'm actually working with a Japanese label called M Record based in Osaka. And it's actually for this compilation, it's actually the first time we introduce this music for the for worldwide audience, because for the originally it's only released within Thailand, and it was recording, I think, in 1972. And the feedback from Japan and Europe was actually quite great for this, because it's actually an instrumental album, and people actually doesn't have to get through the barrier of the language as well.
Maf Sai, we're going to have to leave it there on a Saturday afternoon, both in Bangkok and London. That was absolutely fantastic. And hopefully we're looking at doing an event down in Thailand quite soon. So we might be calling on your DJing skills if that comes off, somewhere around the World Economic Forum at the beginning of June.
Anytime you visit Thailand, let me know as well.
Okay, Khao Kuk Kun Kun, thank you very much. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
May's Monocle is a well-behaved, waggy-tailed issue that looks at how Japan's passion for poodles and miniature pooches has generated a St. Bernard-sized business sector. We also get a preview of how our cities will look in the future at the world's most important real estate fair, talk soft power with the Goethe Institute, and find a hood to call home in Buenos Aires. And there's much more. In the business section this month, we get up close and personal with Man's Best Friend in Japan, looking at Tokyo's booming luxury pooch preening market and what it says about the country's social and economic outlook. We also report on the recent resurgence in Turkish heritage brands, meet the cousins who still run the fine leather brand Hermes, and have an in-depth report on the horological highlights of Baselworld Watch Fair.
In the edit section, we open our sheds and explore a Dutch toolmaker that's been leading the gardening business for years. We also share a roast chicken recipe from a cozy takeaway in New York and tip our readers on a trendy Pilates studio in Seoul.
There's also our 36-page travel guide to Thailand, our annual design directory, and Monocle's Helsinki City Survey. The May issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world. This week on The Urbanist, we're looking at how, with the use of statues and monuments, cities commemorate key events in their histories and also their dead yet celebrated residents. We start by talking to Peter Eisenman, the American architect who designed Berlin's controversial yet now loved memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe. Next, it's to Richmond, Virginia, to visit Monument Avenue, which reveals much about the city's colourful Confederate past. Then we find out about a statue of Lenin that ended up in New York City. And in London, we find out about an artsy monument project in Trafalgar Square. Plus, there's our tour stories, news, and of course, this week's Urbanist song.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson, and Tyler Brulé. Every Saturday here in Midori House, we pick some of our favourite magazine titles to rifle through.
And today we're joined by a very dear friend of the family. We're trying to figure out what to call you, Alexi, but we just put fashion entrepreneur. That's what it says on the script. But, you know, you're a former colleague and many other things as well. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi. Many people might know you as the woman and front person behind Henchman, a brand which started off, very much in a pop-up and an online capacity. Tell us about the new season before we jump into magazines. And for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with Henchman,
exciting! It's hit the shop for about a month ago. Bright.
Always bright, right?
Always bright, colorful. biggest collection to date, exciting, and a farther afield.
Really?
You find it Japan, Korea, the States, France, England. I mean, it's getting a little bit bigger.
It's got legs.
It's got legs. It's running.
Walking. Off on a very, very low scale, didn't it?
Yeah.
The white shirt.
We just did just shirts, exactly. The white shirt and then a few more colors. And then a trouser and then a few more of those, and it grew really organically in that way. And now it's a full collection. Just finished designing Spring Summer 13, which has now got prints and accessories and shoes and sunglasses. I mean, it grew.
And is Henchwoman around the corner?
No, every time I come here, you ask me.
We have to
still
ask
not.
You.
Still okay. Not.
No, I think that's good. I'm just
not and never.
I'm trying to keep you honest.
Not and never. Never, never.
I don't think so.
Why not?
I don't think I'm capable of it, really. I think it's good to stick to one thing and make it really good rather than just start to dart off into all sorts of directions.
Mm.
It wouldn't be my forte, I don't think.
Right.
To do the women's.
So let's stick with, there's a bit of a menswear theme that we have. I see you've got Fantastic Man in front of you. So why don't we crack the spine and tell us about the issue, what you've liked.
I generally like this magazine for its photography.
Hmm.
I'd say for its still life originally, but this issue, actually, the latest issue, doesn't really have very much.
In terms of the way of still life?
Still life. I think the first four or five issues had some really interesting sort of shots of really banal things, like the white shirt, but shot so beautifully. I think it was referenced by so many different designers in so many different places. And that's, I think, what made the magazine really interesting in the beginning. And it's now, got legs, as you say, and it's gotten bigger and a bigger appeal, and it's gone a bit away from that. I think it fell into a bit more of a fashion magazine. So I think that's what this issue's about, actually. It's got a pretty cool, very sort of glossy fashion spread on shot in Palm Springs. I mean, I think some of the fashion is a bit questionable.
Right.
The photography's fun and it's beautiful, I think.
You're looking at the piece that's shot in Palm Springs, which is, a really vibrant story. I'm trying to get to the front of it. It's by Daniel Riera, I believe. I'm just getting to the front of the story. Daniel Riera shot it. Someone who also has shot for us quite a bit, styled by Jody Barnes. It's interesting. I think photographically it's a really beautiful story. The actual fashion, I think, sort of takes a departure and goes somewhere a little bit I feel a little bit different from where they've been before.
Yeah, I think it got a bit more fashionable.
Right.
It was. It's less about that really stern sort of fantastic man, that guy.
Yeah.
And got a little bit more vogue, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Just to say that Matthew Slotover of Frieze Art Fair fame has been on the cover. And this is one of the things I really like about what they do, is that they're always sort of celebrating. I wouldn't say, you know, Matthew Slotover's definitely not an everyday character, but he's, you know, he's certainly known to a certain constituency around the world. And it's great that you can make someone like this, you know, a cover star on a fashion magazine, as opposed to saying that you have to dip into the music industry or you have to dip into film or television to get a recognized name, or indeed even putting another designer on the cover.
I was astonished by the simplicity of the image on the front cover, that he's not being placed in any situation or in any pose. It is just a simple shot of him. And what I quite enjoyed about it is the very gentlemanly approach to the text. Actually, I found the grooming section absolutely fascinating. That it has a very respectful tone to it, and a very sort of respectful enthusiasm to the way that it is written and the way it's laid out. Mm. I mean, a beautiful picture of our favourite manicure model, and they have this beautiful hand being sort of gently rubbed. And
right.
It's just delightful to look at.
But do you respond to that? I mean, of course, obviously, you know, the gentlewoman is the other title, you know, in the stable, and you know, but as someone who consumes magazines, as a woman, does that the simplicity of it chime with you?
Yes, it does, actually, because you find so much being thrown at you in other areas, that actually for someone to simply write a very good reference to a homemade face pack that a designer had once invented in his own kitchen using egg white and honey has a really gentle and charming tone to it that you don't necessarily get in many other magazines which throw new products and brands at you.
Yeah.
And the fact that everybody's referred to as Mr. I found absolutely delightful.
Yeah, no, that sort of sense of old charm. I really like the story that they have on the sport walking twins.
Yeah.
And I know
yes, and that was very fun.
on Daniel and Dominic King, and this to me, I know maybe Alexia, this to me sort of strikes me as very original, fantastic man. It's an ingenious story. It has, you know, it's got a great sort of setup and interview that goes with it. And then it's a brilliant fashion story. It's shot by Andreas Larsson. And I thought, you know, it's also good for maybe a couple of tips for you, because, you know, as you're sort of getting back around the park, Emma, I think this would be quite, in fact, you know, we could actually develop a shtick and be race walking twins around Regent's Park.
Well, bring your pram, Tyler, and I'll be waiting for you at the gate.
I was actually thinking, though, just earlier, though, just referencing the earlier story, that there is potential that you could maybe take a cue from our DJ who we had on when you're talking about his midweek rejuvenation sessions of free spiritual jazz. I mean, who needs the pushy Mom's Day?
Well, no, absolutely. We could do free spiritual jazz while running around the park,
and then right after.
We could really push the boat out there.
Alexi, what was your favorite piece? I think when you look through this,
I think it is the shoot in Palm Springs, like we were talking about. I'm not sure about some of the fashion,
but just the story.
But the photography is really beautiful.
Yeah. And,
it makes you want to be in Palm Springs right now.
What is
there's something really glossy, but not cheesy glossy, like just beautifully shot.
What is it about the fashion that doesn't attract you there? Because
I think it
has a very certain style to it.
Well, like Tyler was saying, I think it's sort of it's something different or new that Fantastic Man has sort of done, and it's gotten a little bit fashion. Mm. What I like about, for example, the walk shoot is that it's got humor to it, and I think there's humor throughout Fantastic Man. They seem to, especially in the beginning, some of these little pieces about when they, you know, talk about things like sandwiches or,
yeah,
you know, paper clips, and they do it in such a fun way, and you get the impression that the team behind it is a really great bunch of people and you want to meet them all. And this shoot, I think, doesn't have that humor. It just has slightly like going over the fashion guys, I think.
Exactly.
It's very posture.
Whereas the walk is humorous.
Have you found since you started Henchman that you look at magazines in a different way from a commercial perspective? And I mean, I think before I moved into the magazine business, there was a certain sort of enjoyment. And I really have to just shift down five gears to really enjoy magazines, because I look at them from a competitive perspective. It's business. It's like, you know, you want to see who shot something. You want to see who's advertising. So there's a different rhythm. And I'm wondering for you, you know, whether it's sort of points of inspiration or too much influence when you look at a story in Palm Springs, thinking, oh God, you know, do I need to be doing, you know, massive oversized check next season? Hopefully
yeah,
not.
I mean,
I don't know, but
absolutely. Every time I look at anything, from a store catalog to a magazine to a newspaper to whatever it is, I'm always thinking, I mean, do I need to be doing that? Is that the direction I need to be going in? You know, we have our press company, our PR company is always trying to get me to do press pieces. So a white shirt is not exciting to photograph. It's just not. So, you know, if they're trying to put our stuff in the press, they're like,
don't
why
talk
don't
about
you
to
make...
Emma in her tuxedo shirt this morning.
But it's a tuxedo shirt. It's different. It's great.
See, when is a white shirt not a white shirt? You see, we've already moved away from it. How much do you actually, how much attention do you actually pay to these sort of clamours to do press
Well,
pieces
that's my or... point. Like, I like to think that I can sort of do what I want, but then you read a magazine and you realize that the things that are being shot are a crazy, you know, floral Kenzo thing or, you know, a big overly sized check shirt or whatever. And you're like, well, if you want to get your stuff in there, I guess there's something in it. Maybe you have to be doing parts of that as well. Maybe I have to make one or two pieces that will be photographed so that the rest of the collection sort of, you know, makes it in there too. Or
I'm intrigued. You know, we have one way that we work editorially here, but when you deal with other men's magazines and other titles, how much do you feel you have to also play, not just the PR game today, but if you know, if you want to, you know, really get your items out there, especially in more mass titles, that there has to be sort of a promise of advertising or doing a party or an event. Yeah. Have you found that pressure? Because I think when you're new on the block, everyone does want the new. You're three seasons old. It's like a little bit, well, show us the money if you want to, yeah, us to sustain that relationship. Are you finding that now?
Yeah, I think it's exhausting. You know, you think that you come out with a collection and that's a big deal, and then your press company's like, well, no. Everyone else did. So what? What's the next thing? Are you going to make a movie? Are we going to have some moving caravan, you know, that's going to go all over London and sell stuff? Are we going to do 8 pop-ups in 10 days around the world? Like, what is it? And you're constantly not just creating a collection, which is the core of what I do and other designers do, but then having to create the noise around it. And there's so many different things that you have to do, be it from social media constantly to new ideas about... you know, just how to get more than just the collection out.
And how do you make sure that you retain the core without jumping on jumping on every bandwagon that you're supposed to?
Well, I think it's a question of surrounding yourself by good people, making sure that you don't start to do too many of the things and you employ people to do what they're better at. Like, you know, right now we're working on a film that we want to use for the London Fashion Week for men in June. And it's a question of just getting better people than me to work on a film. I'm not a filmmaker, but obviously I'm going to work on the ideas and stuff. So it's just doing what I do best and then making sure that other people, you know, do what they do best. And
this will be a promotional piece, like a little short. You're not making feature film.
No.
Disney's not involved.
No.
It must be quite unusual, though, giving control, artistic control to someone,
yeah,
like a filmmaker.
Impossible.
When
I mean, it's a battle.
How do you give artistic control, or do you just, is it like you say, is it a battle?
It's a battle. I think you probably have a similar sort of.
I've never heard of creative conflict. I don't know what you're talking about.
It's no such thing.
Entirely consensual.
It's just you know, your vision, your notion of something. When someone else is going to start playing with it, it's really hard to let it go. But it's a question, like I was saying, of just getting people on board that are better at what they do than, you know, what you are,
yeah,
what you do. And you know, and obviously you have to, you know, mesh and your ideas have to work together. But it's finding those people, surrounding yourself with them, and then just like sort of trusting that, you know, they can do a better job than you can. But, you know, I'm very involved, I would say.
Without losing too much sleep at night.
I mean, I don't sleep anymore.
I just want to, you've got inventory there, but I want to go under the stack. You've got...
Lula.
Yeah, I've got Lula.
Lula's nice because I work in menswear now. I read magazines almost for education.
Right.
You know, Lula's got nothing to do with that. It's just aesthetic. It's just beautiful photography. It's very feminine. It's very girly. I don't even really read women's magazines so much anymore unless I'm traveling. Like, I'll pick up a Vogue or something.
Right.
But... But this is just really something that you want to look through for pure pleasure.
Right.
You know, it's...
But, and again, that's artistic pleasure when you look at it, because I wouldn't ever say, I wouldn't dare sort of say that your style is girly. So
no.
your personal style. So again, that's just photographic cues, just looking at great lighting and really, you know, the construction of a great magazine.
Absolutely.
And does anything for henchmen suddenly appear from there occasionally?
I think, yeah, you know, nothing just comes out of the blue.
No. What's rubbed off on you from Lula?
Just things like this, the softness of it. I think that we try and get some of that in some of our photography, some of the things that we do, a lot of the colors, using a lot of color. The brand Henchman is, you know, obviously a menswear brand, but I think it's quite, not, I wouldn't say feminine, but there is a lot of color to it, and it's not for all guys, and I think that that does come from my like of something like Lula and certain films and certain things that, that don't come from a sort of a Fantastic Man kind of square aesthetic at all, but much the opposite.
It's curious, isn't it? Because, you know, so often you might have to go see a manufacturer, or you're dealing with other people, or you want to develop, you know, a fabric. And it's amazing that, and I've just sort of found that there's almost sort of two ways of sort of people doing research today, that, you know, you have people who just sort of go, you know, go online and they go and try to find 1,000 points of inspiration. But yet, you know, that sort of the cutouts are just sort of people just, you know, reprinting sort of 1,000 web pages is sort of never the same as someone coming with tears out of a magazine.
Yeah, it's the best.
It's amazing, isn't it? And even though all of this, you know, all of these screens surrounding us, that information is there, you know, at the snap of a finger, but still, you know, that Sunday afternoon of just being able to go through magazines and saying, okay, I'm trying to distill an idea, I'm going to tell it in pictures. It's much, you know, it's more readily done, I still think, through the pages of Coat Suit if you're doing a house, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
It may be.
And there's something about the touch, you know. I know that, you know, it doesn't necessarily translate into a final idea, but there's something about what something feels like and smells like. And the fact that, you know, the terror, the sound it makes. I don't know, it's not yeah, it's not like online. I also think that we're of a generation that's just sort of slightly after the whole internet boom. I went to an art school, and we had a picture library, which was one of the biggest picture libraries in the States at the time. And you'd go in and you'd ask for cars from the 1920s, and someone would come out with a file that was just clippings from all sorts of newspapers and magazines, and it was cars from the 20s. And they would, files, you know. And this doesn't exist anymore, doesn't need to exist anymore. You obviously now have Google Image and the internet. But that was pre-internet, and it was such a big deal. It was such an important part of my, schooling. So I still have that, and I still like the actual magazine cutouts.
Where do you go to find that? Is it just in magazine cutouts, or can you find inspiration from other places?
I think everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and the thing about an idea is when you need it, you know, you just can't create ideas like that. I think you have to be collecting all the time.
And if you're given a pile of things, you can actually go and physically bury yourself in them for a couple of hours. It's a sort of a place to focus yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas if you're on the internet, it's constant magpie vision. You're just attracted by each thing that pops up.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different people. Some people have gotten really into the iPad and whatever, and never need a magazine again. They think it's the best thing in the world. I mean, I would never replace a magazine with online. I think there's just something so nice about having these stacks of papers everywhere.
God, Lexi Hench is going to go and sort of do sort of the global advocacy role for us. it is interesting. I think that, you know, and I think part of this program is always talking about, okay, we wouldn't be, you know, delivering ourselves and having this conversation and making it our way, you know, into people's headphones and through speakers, you know, if it wasn't for the web. But, you know, the flip side is that, you know, I think there's always this, you feel there's almost this unilateralism going on, that everyone sort of thinks it needs to be one way. But I think, you know, the more you travel, sort of, you know, the more you see the world, you know, there isn't just one way. There was an interesting piece about BlackBerry the other day, just saying that, you know, okay, we all sort of think that company sort of had it, yet they've gone and sold more devices now to the U.S. government because of the security issue. And you think, wow, okay, you think, well, maybe the U.S. government's moving towards only to iPhones, but yet, because everything is sort of so focused, you know, just on the narrative of the West Coast, et cetera, you think, okay, well, therefore everything's going to be sort of read off a screen like this.
I think it's the fact that things are actually finding their own natural position and role, and no one should really feel that a magazine is massively being threatened, because we all look at the internet for completely different reasons from a magazine. And you sit down and you enjoy Lula because it is visually refreshing and gives you a space and a time that just going through the internet doesn't offer you.
Oh, absolutely. And also, you can do it whenever you want. The thing about the internet is, I mean, it is getting so much more mobile, and you can see it everywhere you go and all that. But you can't just lie in your bed, you know, or on a plane or whatever, and necessarily have that to hand, but you do have a magazine wherever you want it.
I love that feeling of people being neutered on aircraft now, that if you are still a paper person, you've got your, you know, your FT and your Wall Street Journal, whatever you have, and then they say, okay, everyone, you know, turn off your electronic devices right now, and everyone is there with their iPads, and then the plane is on the runway for 1 hour because it's delayed, and you know, you've got sort of all your media, everyone else sort of put their like bags of problems, they're just sort of like sitting there like this, like, yeah, drumming.
When can I get
exactly
back into my,
you know, they've got it, they have to settle for the you know, the dreaded in-flight magazine in the seat pocket in front of them. Alexei, great to see you today.
Thank you.
And are there any sort of pop-ups or anything else happening retail-wise anywhere in the world that you?
Yeah, something for summer. I'm working on it, so.
Okay,
I'll let you know.
You will let us know. That brings us to the end of this edition of the Saturday Review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us in London. Today's show is produced by Katie Bilbao and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell.
You can catch the best of the week's stories next on The Curator. Don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly as well, which will be on air tomorrow at 11 a.m. London time.
Indeed, it will. And you have been listening to The Review here in London. We are just coming up to the top of the hour right now. I think that we should probably put our trainers on and maybe do another round of the park, should we?
And plugging ourselves into the iPod with a bit of Thai funk.
Exactly.
Just for good measure.
It's a goodbye from me, Tyler Berlay, and Emma Nelson.
Bye-bye.